Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today's guest is two-time Olympic champion Alistair Brownlee. He's also a two-time world champion, four-time European champion, and Commonwealth Games champion, and widely regarded as somebody who changed the sport of triathlon, bringing it into a new era of racing demands and intensity. Alistair, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, it's great to be on it. Thank you very much for having me. As I told you, this is one of the few triathlon podcasts I sometimes listen to, so it's fantastic to be here.
Great to hear that, first of all. I think that you'll be the one that does the education today, but it's still good to hear that you find this podcast valuable and or have done so over the years. I want to start with something a bit different than the typical looking back at your career and your training and performance advice, which is you recently raced a Norseman, and I believe that you did it off very little training. So can you talk about what was the experience of doing an extreme iron distance triathlon off of a very limited amount of training?
Well, yeah, firstly, I have spent my entire career and told everyone that endurance sport performance is all about preparation. So, you know, I don't take what I say too seriously now, and I'm definitely relying off 30 years now of training for endurance sport. So I've got, you know, probably a bit of a background. And even though I say I don't do any training, because I do zero structured training, like absolutely zero, like no sessions at all. I do quite a lot of exercise. So, I mean, I don't know what that looks like, but probably say 15 hours a week, you know, average, or 12 to 15 hours a week, say. So, I mean, I'm guessing I'm doing a decent amount of exercise, it's fair to say. And Norseman is obviously one of the toughest kind of long distance races out there, and it was great. I started off on the swim, and I do very, very little swimming, but I've learned two things from not doing very much swimming. One is I have to be incredibly careful with how I pace everything, so I have to set off, swim at my own pace, because for some reason with swimming, it's really different. If you go into the red, and it seems to me, to be really easy to kind of go into the red in those first few minutes on any swim that I do, I just can't recover from it. So I literally had to just sit off slow and swim at my own pace and let the group go and swim the whole thing on my own. On the bike, I got a bit carried away and rode a bit hard in the first hour and a half, and then spent a bit of time in the middle recovering from that and finished the rest of the bike. And the scenery and it kept me going. It's just fantastic race. So for those that don't know, there's loads of climbing. You climb almost 1,200 meters straight out of the fjord right at the start, right onto a big plateau, and then you climb over four or five different mountains. Then as you go through the bike and descend down to the run start, and then at the run start, the run is 25 kilometers on the flat to start with, which I actually got into and was quite enjoying, and then you hit the climb, and to say it's bonkers that it's 17 kilometers uphill from that point. The last 17 kilometers of an Ironman distance event are just uphill. The first 12 of those, it's running on a road, you know, like running up an alpine climb. I think, you know, 800 meters more or more of ascent. Like running up Alpe d'Huez or something, and on the road, and it's just long straights as well. So you're running for a couple of kilometers at a time in a straight line, up, I don't know, a 7 or 8% gradient, I think. And then you hit the rocky bit for the last 5 kilometers. And yeah, that's a combination of running and walking. What's important, I think, one, pace yourself, which I did well in some elements of it and some elements not. Second, good equipment and knowing you can rely on your equipment is really important. Fantastic support who know what to give you and when, and a massive emphasis on nutrition. I've really learned that with everything I've done in the last 12 months, especially being underprepared for stuff. If you keep yourself really well fueled, really well hydrated, plenty of electrolytes on board, you can kind of get away with a bit more.
Yeah, that's those are good lessons. Do you think that, is there one particular aspect of the, let's call it the power duration curve or speed duration curve, that you lose more easily and that, or that you retain more easily, if you put it another way. For example, do you find when you talk about avoiding going into the red swimming, does that mean that you still have, if you need it, a 100, 200 meter punch off the start line, but you just have to decide not to use it because then the durability isn't there, the endurance side isn't there? Is that what it feels like for you?
Well, I think swimming is a unique case because I've literally done none of it. I did Patagon Man last year, end of last year, and I literally hadn't swum a single stroke in a swimming pool in the year since I retired. And I did that. I've maybe done 4 or 5 sessions since then, and still not been in a proper swimming pool. Literally none of it. I've probably maybe done 4 or 5K in total, you know? So, I'm completely relying on having a technique and general fitness. So I'm not sure the power speed duration curve applies there. I never had a very good 100 meter punch anyway, even at my fittest. So, but probably proportionally, that's still not that bad. In general, not talking about swimming and talking about especially cycling, actually, I probably haven't lost too much in the kind of mid zone of that power duration curve, say, like around LT1. And I was kind of thinking when I analyzed the Ironman data, probably 5 to 10% I've lost there. I am probably 5 to 10% heavier as well. So obviously the kind of combination of those factors have quite a big impact. I've definitely lost probably similar, if not a bit more, in terms of like the, let's say, the VO2 type zone, 3 to 5 minute of duration efforts, because I do literally zero training for that, but not much considering I don't do much. And it has definitely confirmed my general theory in endurance training that the by far the bedrock to all endurance performance just comes from volume, steady state volume, and you can get a long way off consistent steady state volume.
Yeah, well, that's a great segue into what the next segment of the podcast is going to be, which is basically your views on training and how to reach your peak endurance performance. So can you elaborate on that, on volume, and maybe exemplify as well with what that looked like in practice in your career?
I think the human body is evidently an incredibly complicated thing. And to be honest, the actual evidence we know, and by evidence, I mean peer-reviewed published research in terms of endurance training, what we know is pretty weak, inconsistent, and in terms of advising how we should train, because people are very different, because athletes have different levels, train very differently anyway, and training fundamentally actually is very hard to quantify. Obviously, we've come a long way in the last decade of how we quantify training, both in internal, external load and recovery in terms of wearable data and pulling all that together. But we still, triathlon especially, is really hard to quantify how we train. And I think at the level of overcomplicating things, that we instead, if you kind of take a simple high level view of, look, I mean, everything we know about the human body in some form is a dose-response relationship. And the more dose you can get, the bigger your response. And in this case, dose means exercise, and response means get fitter, faster, stronger. And so what do you do if you work back from that? How do you maximize the dose? And of course, the dose isn't just how much training you can do this week. We know that the time frame for genuine endurance changes, which is everything from cardiac remodeling to increased capillarization to metabolic efficiency and increased mitochondrial density and everything else, takes months, if not years, to fully show up. And so you have to look at the dose of how do I maximize that dose over those months and years. And working back again, you do that by training at a level that you can maintain for that time, you know, in that volume envelope effectively. And so the question is, how can I maximize the training that I do week in, week out, with the kind of belief that I've got to be able to do this for months at a time? And there's loads of things that come about from that. How can you make it habitual? How can you make it fun? How can you make it as easy as possible for yourself, of all those things? And you come back both So both from a, I think, a psychological habit point of view and the physiology, you come from, you come at the end to do, you do as much training as you possibly can at a low intensity. And I think from a habit point of view, that's easy to do, just get out the door and do easy stuff. From a physiological point of view, I think I've probably only become more convinced that it's really easy to do that easy intensity training to slightly too high intensity. And I mean, who knows? None of us know for sure. I know there's quite a lot of work in the space of whether, let's say, that kind of moving up towards your LT1, high zone 2, mid zone 2, whatever type intensity is more effective per minute for doing XYZ. Although even most of the time in sports science, we don't even know what XYZ is because we don't know what the determining factor to win triathlon is most of the time. But even though it might be more effective, it is incredibly, it's way more fatiguing and is metabolically very different. And yeah, I think that if you can accumulate the vast majority of your volume at a low intensity and do some high intensity around that, that's the key. And then, of course, we can debate about what that some high intensity is. And there is, you know, there is merit to that. But I think the thing that I always try and get across is actually that high intensity bit is the metaphorical icing on the cake. You know, you can ice a small cake that you've developed from, and it doesn't matter how much icing you put on a small cake, or you can try and ice a massive cake and you're much better off icing a massive cake. And actually the icing is less of a contributor to the whole kind of performance package than most of us probably think.
And did you always train like this pretty much from the start, or did your time start to do your easy training at a lower intensity to be able to do more of it? Did you change the amount of intensity that was part of your program when you started to view it more as the icing on the cake? Basically, what is the background in your own training of this theory?
Yeah, I mean, my training was very much a constant work of exploration of how can I maximize what I'm doing. And to answer that question directly, no, I definitely started off doing more in high intensity training and doing too much in probably middle intensity zones. I then realized that if I wanted to do the maximum amount of volume I could possibly do and ultimately protect the really high intensity sessions, the way to do that was to make the vast majority of the volume as low intensity as possible. What does that look like in practice? At my very best, my bike ride would say be averaging 200 watts. And this is for someone who probably had a kind of FTP type threshold at 400 watts or more. And I'd do a lot of my running at 5 minute a kilometer pace. Again, when I could run, you know, a sub 29 minute 10K. So it was proportionally incredibly, incredibly easy and incredibly slow. Everyone who ever came to train with me was always surprised by how slow I was going most of the time. As I said, that did two things. It allowed me to maximize my volume and protect the really high intensity sessions. And I learned that somewhere probably in my late teens, early 20s. Actually, probably a lot of it from training with Johnny, you know, for our teens, we'd get competitive and go out and race, and then quite quickly realize that we couldn't do the hard sessions when we needed to do them. And that kind of aligned with my philosophy then of maximizing volume and came on that. And then there was definitely points in my career when I, you know, things just edged outside of that. I started riding a bit harder for a reason, or started, especially as I started playing around with doing different distances, you know, put in more middle zone type intensity, and would realize, and then for whatever reason, something prompted me on having to then kind of have a different focus and making sure some of my other training stayed really, really steady. So yeah, I'd definitely go out the last few years of when I was training properly, I was going out and riding on my own. And when I was riding on my own, I was riding at 200 watts and being really quite strict about how hard I was riding.
Yeah. And with maximizing volume then, how much would that be per week roughly in terms of the hours that you were doing?
At most, 35, probably average. my big weeks might go up to kind of 40 hours of training. And that obviously kind of changed depending on what I was training for, the kind of Olympic distance days, swimming 5 days a week, cycling 6 or 7 days a week. So swimming was about 7 to 7.5 hours of training, cycling, I think 15 to 18 plus hours, and running, when I was really running a lot, trying to run well for Olympic distance, I think I got up to sometimes 12 runs in a week. So, you know, quite kind of 12 hours of running. That adds up to a lot of training. But I mean, to say the percentage of what was intense, swimming, higher percentage of what was intense. So although even if we broke it down meter to meter, I reckon it could still be 10 to 20%. Running out of, if I was running 10 to 12 hours, say 120, 130, 140 kilometers a week, I would do 15 of those with any kind of intensity. And cycling, I'd quite often ride a 15, 18 hour week and do 1 or 2 hours of intensity in it. So really small percentages.
Yeah. And what was the nature of that intensity?
Swimming, what I developed was it was basically always one, called it a VO2 session, but basically a harder type session, 100 meter reps, so one minute reps ish, 15 to 20 of those standards, and one slightly longer threshold style session. So that could be anything from 1 to 5 minute rep plus volume of 3K ish. Running, it was a track session that would be more, not that we looked at it like this, but VO2 focused, again, like 5 by a K or 800 reps or something, and one longer rep type session that you could say was more threshold determined. And cycling, it was a type of a 1 hour chain gang, and sometimes some hill reps. So again, like, I guess the 1 hour chain gang is a bit more, I mean, a really good race simulation, actually, a combination of all intensities in one that I was actually always a big fan of doing, and something else that could be kind of higher intensity focused.
Yeah. You did have some injuries, though. Do you think that was based on just your individual anatomy, perhaps, and your body just not being as resilient to taking on metabolic load as mechanical load? Or do you think that it might have been because you were pushing the envelope with volume? The intensity wasn't a big amount in terms of the proportions of the volume, but still, when you do that amount of volume, there's also a fair bit of intensity regardless, and probably the running, a lot of it was at quite fast paces, right? So what's your take on the injuries looking back?
It's multifactorial, isn't it? It's definitely the number one thing with injuries is always look at the, you know, Occam's razor, always look for the obvious thing first, which is if you get injured, it's probably because you're doing too much, which, you know, load. And I was doing a lot, but that was a very conscious decision. I wanted to stand on the start line of the Olympics thinking, I've done everything I possibly can here to maximize my chances. And I was purposely testing out kind of where that limit was all the time. And so injuries came from that. The intelligent question to ask is, could I have done a similar load with a different physiology or different biomechanical kind of gait or better recovery or all those things? And the answer is probably yes. So there's bits rounds of the edges that could have helped, but they're actually not necessarily that relevant. It was really the question is, how much load can you do given the recovery you can do on that day and your biomechanics and everything? And yeah, when you get injured on the whole, it's because you've done a bit too much.
I think it's almost a stupid question because the answer is probably almost certainly yes, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think it's necessary to take reasonably big risks with load and with potentially risking injury to achieve something like an Olympic goal? Whereas maybe for you at the level you were at, if you wanted to just, you know, be one of the 5 to 10 best triathletes in the world, you can do that pretty easily with just the consistent training. But getting that, taking the, being confident that you can potentially win the Olympics, you need to take that extra level of risk. Is that something that you've thought of?
I think that's a good question. And I don't think it's quite as simple as that. Because, I mean, the juxtaposition of endurance training is what I started by saying, that really you want to maximize, let's say, the volume, the dose over a long period of time. And you do that by being consistent. And how do you be consistent? You train at 80 or 90% the whole time, you know, so you're reducing the risk of injury, because if you're injured for a few weeks and you miss out on, let's call it 100 hours of dose to catch that up over 50, even 50 weeks, that's an extra 2 hours a week. Over 10 weeks, it's 5 hours a week. So it's really hard. So in theory, the vast majority of benefits you get are by training at a consistent level week in, week out over a long period of time. Can most people push that higher? Yes. What is too high? You don't know till you get there, is it, to answer the question. Is that necessary to win the Olympics? You don't know until you do it. You know, for some people, they don't maybe need to get anywhere near there. For some people, the risk reward might pay off. You know, you're absolutely prepared to throw everything you've got at it for a few weeks to get there. I think many athletes, their psychology and their coach's psychology dictates that they'd actually prefer to arrive at the Olympic Games at 95% of their ability, say, and be healthy, which is absolutely fine. You know, if that's what you want to do, and some athletes are prepared to risk everything to potentially arrive there at 100%, knowing that if it goes wrong, you've fallen off the edge of the cliff and it's bust. But that I think that's a psychological thing.
Thank you to Precision Fuel Hydration for supporting today's episode. Precision Fuel Hydration make fueling and hydration simple. Their gels, like the PF30, PF90, and the caffeinated PF30, are easy to consume due to the pleasant but not overpowering flavor. And they are very easy to count carbs with, because they have 30 grams or 90 grams of carbs, not 23 or 22 and a half, which I've had lots of gels with those amounts in the past. And that's not easy at kilometer 30 of an Ironman. They also have carb only and carb plus electrolyte drink mixes, plus electrolyte tablets and sachets of different strengths, so you can match them to your sweat sodium concentration. And they have tons of science-based articles in their knowledge hub on the website, including an amazing case study database where you can filter for things like event type, heat and humidity, and the sweat sodium concentration of the athlete, and lots more, which is incredibly valuable because you can basically try to match your athlete type and your race type. And you can see what has worked for world-class athletes, including athletes winning world championships over the Ironman and Ironman 7.3. So visit precisionfuelhydration.com and use the code TTS2026 to get 15% off from your first order.
Yeah. What did you think of in your active career, or how did you approach outside factors to the training itself? So recovery, nutrition, and all of those things, was that something you paid a lot of attention to and was very intentional about?
It, I must admit, it changed enormously throughout my career. If you'd asked me this question as a 21, 22, 23 year old, I would have said, actually, recovery doesn't matter that much. I can do all the training I want to do, and as long as I get 8 hours of sleep a night, that'll be okay. And it doesn't matter what I eat, because it all gets broken down into carbohydrates, fat, and protein anyway. So that could literally be a pie from the local shop or a curry or whatever, and it's all the same thing. And it doesn't seem to affect me. And then, yeah, throughout my career, I mean, that changed drastically. I think anyone who's got a bit older and as their body changes knows that. And definitely as you get an older athlete, you really have to focus on recovery more, because you naturally, I think that's the main thing probably I noticed in speaking to other people. People talk about your kind of natural ability to recover declines, and so you focus on it more. And yeah, I mean, that went from everything to making sure I was sleeping well, making sure my everyday nutrition was as good as it possibly could be, really working on the kind of, on making sure I was kind of mentally fresh and ready to train very hard and happy in a training environment and enjoying what I was doing. All of that became much more important.
How did you, anything else other than training environment when it comes to making sure that you were mentally fresh? Did you have anything else that you did specifically there?
I never actively did any kind of psychological intervention as it was. But I always thought being mentally relaxed was quite important to me. So actually having other things and other interests going on was important away from sport. And I would be really conscious of switching off, not spending time on social media, like not kind of reading too much about triathlon, reading books, kind of being mentally stimulated and kind of being relaxed away from what I saw as the kind of my sphere, my everyday sphere of a job in sport. And sleeping during the day. I think sleeping during the day is amazing if you can do it.
Yeah. And how much sleep would you get if you include both nighttime sleep and naps on a, let's say not on a good day, but on a typical and an average day?
I think I easily would average over 8 hours a night, probably 9 hours. And at my very peak, I would sleep most days. I'd sleep an hour during the day or so. So getting a lot of sleep, and the kind of general day would be swim in the morning. So it could be something like a swim and a run in the morning and then a cycle and a run in the afternoon, with a break to kind of relax and sleep in the middle of the day, something like that. The very easy sessions became a kind of a part of my active recovery. I thought that, any session that isn't an intense session or a very long bike ride, you should come back feeling better than you started. And the easy rides that I do during the week, if I went out and rode a couple of hours, the goal would be to come back feeling better than I started. And that would be, I'd do that by keeping it a really low intensity. And more, actually, I rode off-road. I'd go out and ride a gravel bike, because I found it kind of mentally more refreshing, or a mountain bike as well.
Yeah. With one final question on sleep, is there anything, any sort of tricks or tools that you used to help you get the best quality sleep and enough duration of sleep that you found helpful?
I think sleep is one of those things that we all know how to do well, but actually it's easy to say and practice can be quite difficult. So, the standard things of go to bed at the same time. And since we might talk about it later, but I've done a lot of research in big data in sleep science. And the number one signal that keeps coming out is consistency. People who are consistent at when they go to bed have the best sleep and recovery. There's no doubt about it. So going to bed at the same time, dark, cool rooms, quiet, not eating too close to sleep. I found that eating, sugar, high carbohydrate-y things at night affected my sleep. No screens, reading before you go to bed is really good. Getting up at the same time every day, not too early in the morning. I think early training is probably bad for you most of the time, if you can avoid it, if you can. Since I didn't have one in my career, but I've actually recently got an Aid Sleep, and I'm not just mentioning it from a product sponsorship point of view, because it's not that, but it genuinely, that is a amazing game changer, I think, in sleep, because we've been having a heat wave in the UK. I know that might sound ridiculous to lots of people, but we actually have. And to get into a cold, temperature controlled bed at night is definitely a game changer. I spent a lot of time sleeping in an altitude tent during my career as well. And that's not necessarily that good for your sleep, because it's hot and noisy and obviously thin air in there.
Does the Aid Sleep, because I've never used it or seen it in the flesh, but does it still allow you to use an altitude tent so that you could kind of counteract the inside the heat of the altitude tent with the temperature control of the aid sleep?
Yeah, you definitely could. I mean, it just looks like a normal mattress, and it goes over the top of the mattress and doesn't really make it any bigger. So yeah, you could just still use the tent on top of your normal mattress. It'd be really effective. I spent all kinds of ways trying to work out how to keep my altitude tent cool. Including having the generator outside at points, even having my altitude tent and the generator outside in separate tents. Try to build a refrigeration system around the air inlet coming into the tent. Tried all sorts over the years. So to have an 8-sleep mattress in an altitude tent would be really good.
But it's actually, yeah, it's really interesting that you mentioned the altitude tent though. So how much time do you spend in a typical year at actual altitude? And then would you use the altitude tent basically anytime you were home outside of those camps, or was it more specific in strategic periods of the year?
Yeah, specific strategic periods of the year. Altitude, I thought, was very effective for me. And both the tent and training and living at altitude definitely worked. I didn't use it all year round because I thought I got the vast majority, like most physiological responses, yeah, you have a kind of standard kind of response curve where the gradient is quite steep to start off and then levels off quite quickly. And apart from long-term endurance training, which is takes a lot longer to level off, unlike most other physiological responses. I think I probably got a lot of the benefits quite quickly in 3 or 4 weeks. And then, you know, it was diminishing returns after that. So I'd use it kind of strategically in the lead up to big races, in between times when I train at altitude, in the lead up to going to an altitude camp, that kind of thing. I personally found it too stressful to sleep in it all the time. You know, I wanted periods off where I just slept normally and relaxed.
Yeah. Looking back at your career, is there anything that you would have done differently in terms of actual things that you did related to your performance, to your training, etc., now that you have all this knowledge? Maybe this is something that you already implemented at the back end of your career, but that you would have liked to do earlier. Does anything come to mind?
Yeah, of course. I could literally talk for weeks on the things that I would have done and could have done differently. But the point is, you're kind of hindsight and playing with fire. You know, what I ultimately did led me to win 2 Olympic gold medals, and I wouldn't change that for anything. So I actually wouldn't change anything. But that is not to say that there aren't many things that I could have done better, from the very simple of, you know, I wish on that day at that time I didn't go for that extra run, you know, the obvious, and got injured, to the more complicated of, yeah, how I could have recovered better, how I could have fueled better, how I could have been more strategic about this and that. Many, many things.
So if I rephrase that question, and I'll use one of the listener questions that I got. This one is from Matti Armelt, too. It's an Instagram handle anyway. So he asks, what advice would you give yourself if you can go back in time? So you get the chance to go back and give yourself some advice. What do you say?
Well, again, I wouldn't want to change anything. So I'd be very careful doing that. And again, you know, we have to be really careful with interventions, I think, when we're dealing with coaching, and because there's so many unintended consequences. So yeah, you are very much playing with fire. I would tell myself, keep going, you know, have faith in what you're doing. Try and step back every so often and have a bit of a view on the bigger picture. And by that, you know, there's quite a few times where, you know, I didn't want to miss that session because of injury, or that race because of injury, actually. And actually a bit more perspective on things would have been very valuable, and I don't think that would have led to any negative consequences, but you never know.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on your long distance career? So the 7.3 and Ironman part of your career. There was obviously an overlap there with short course racing as well. Do you look back on it and
Are you happy with what you achieved? You got two silvers in the 73 World Championships. But I guess a lot of people would have looked at you and thought that you could win the Ironman World Championships one day, which you in the end didn't do. Is that something that you have any regrets over, or what do you think about this part of your career?
Definitely. I mean, I have regrets on all of my career, really. You always could have done more, which is one of the things about being an athlete. You don't become a successful athlete by being content easily. And so that means even, I imagine, the very most successful of athletes of all time have got things that they regret and things that they would like to achieve that they didn't achieve. And of course, there's the fantastic quote by Roger Federer saying that even him is at the time the most successful tennis player of all time. I think won just over 50% of points that he played. So yeah, I mean, that's part of sport. At long distance, yeah, for sure, I would have loved to have achieved more. I would have loved to win the Ironman World Championships. I think, yeah, of course, there's ways that I could have approached that better and trained better and fueled better and prepared better and, yeah, many, many things. I think the number one determinant ultimately was I could have been a lot more successful if I started earlier. But that would have meant not going to that next Olympic Games in Rio and winning there. So yeah, in sport, ultimately, you can't have everything. And I'm I can sit here happy to say, relatively content with what I achieved.
Yeah. But do you think, because you still raced a little bit in 2017 and 2018, at least 2017, you started the Tokyo Olympic cycle. So there was a period of a couple of years with overlapping short course and long course. Do you think that if you had completely stopped after Rio, could that have made a difference?
Could it have made a difference? I mean, I did pretty much stop, actually. 2017, 2018, I did pretty much focus on long distance. And yeah, I probably should have just wholly focused on long distance at that point. So maybe the mistake was thinking, kind of half-heartedly thinking about going to Tokyo. And I should have at that point fully focused on long distance. And that was a mistake. Would it have made a difference? I don't know. I mean, probably, but who knows?
Yeah. What do you think, short distance-wise and long distance-wise, in each of those two, what is the highest level race you were ever in where you felt that the level of the racing was the highest?
I think for short distance, the London Olympic Games. That was crazy high level. It was, you know, super fast swim, bike and run. And the run was just, you know, incredibly fast. The swim was really, really quick. The bike was quick. And then the first 2.5K of the run was 7 minutes flat, which you know, 28-minute 10K pace. And then I ran a 29-minute 10K. And in those conditions on that course, was definitely there. And long distance, the 70.3 in South Africa, which Jan Frodeno won. I was second and Javier Gomez was third. And first 70.3, we actually had a pretty close race on the run. And yeah, the swim had been pretty on and then the bike had been pretty hard for most of it. And then, yeah, the run was super quick. It was a great race to be part of.
Yeah, I actually thought that you would answer those two, or at least from the outside looking in, those were the ones that I would have picked. I entertained myself with calculating based on a 3% running economy improvement from super shoes, if we estimate that to meaning a 2% performance improvement roughly, that London 2012 run split that you did would have been about. It was, I can remember the exact time, is it 28, because you did 29.07, it would have been 28.30. I think it was roughly 1 second faster than Alex Yee's current fastest 10K in an Olympic distance triathlon. So, because that was, of course, pre super shoes, and that was also with some slowing down on the blue carpet to take it all in. So that was, I think, for people that haven't watched that race, I think that's a
a race, but especially a run that is worth watching from just a triathlon history point of view. I think that was spectacular. A couple of more questions on sort of looking at how athletes are training now and comparing it to how you are doing or how you were doing things. What do you think are the general trends today in elite triathletes? I mean, I know it can be difficult because people are doing different things, but if you think there are any overarching trends, what do you think they are? And are there big differences compared to how you were doing things in your active career?
I must admit, I'm a bit disconnected, to be honest. So I don't know necessarily what people are doing day in, day out. And that is one of the challenges, isn't it, of making a call on like training trends, because it's quite easy to say, this is how this person trains. But without a good overview of exactly what they've done for the last 6 months and quite a detailed breakdown, you don't actually know. I don't know. I think still the bedrock of consistent training over a long period of time has to be there. I think in short distance triathlon, is quite interesting, both tactically and physiologically, because tactically, very few athletes get full control of the outcome, and you have like cycles of races being a bit more run dominated and then being a bit more swim dominated, and that doesn't tend to be down to one athlete. It tends to be down to like a combination and kind of dynamics, and depending on what kind of area you're in, you probably have to train maybe a little bit different for that, depending on the kind of athlete you are. For example, if it's a sprint distance race in a swim bike dominated era that we've kind of seen a bit at the moment in the men's racing, your ability to get a race result could be determined completely by your first 2 minutes of the swim or the last minute of the swim and the first 2 minutes on the bike to make that front group. And that's a pure like VO2 max type effort on the swim and bike that you've got to train. And that's different to training to be the fastest 5K runner you can be. So that's interesting. So I don't know whether people think about that differently, but you can see that people have worked out. If you look at Matt Hauser from Australia, he's worked out that right, my way to increases my chances of success are by racing with this tactic. And I imagine he's training to race with that tactic in a to an extent. I think in long distance, I think there's lots of long distance actually probably allows more latitude in terms of how people train for it, because it's in lots of ways such a kind of funny metabolically challenged intensity in the middle there, and so you do see a lot of variation in how people train for it, which is fascinating to look at as an observer.
And I mean, you're clearly very interested in training and in sports science and all sorts of things, but you haven't actually stepped into coaching at any point that I'm aware of, or even things like performance director roles, things like that, which I guess a lot of athletes in your position could have chosen to do. What is the reason for that? Is it just not something that interests you?
Well, maybe at the moment I'm actually enjoying, in some ways, enjoying a bit of a break from from triathlon, but doing my own sport, and I think that's quite a good thing. So maybe I'll do something at some point. I actually did coach Beth Potter for 2 or 3 years. I helped her. She came to me in 2021 and said, basically, I need help getting to the front of races and being an Olympic, someone who can win the Olympics in Paris. And I kind of put together, I guess, a strategy and helped her on her way to get that medal in Paris, and enjoyed doing that. I fundamentally believe coaching, especially high-level athletes, you have to be a very, very involved. You know, the value is being there day in, day out to me. It's about being the person who goes running with them and goes cycling with them and is there at the swim sessions, but especially riding a bike and understanding how the training's going and being able to help them technically and tactically. Because actually writing the program is is kind of the easy bit, and being able to deliver it at that level, that's what you owe an elite top level athlete to do it. Ultimately, it's not only their goal and their career, is it? It's their health, it's their dreams, it's everything. And I think you have to be really involved. And ultimately, I just don't feel like I'm ready to be that involved in helping people at the moment do that. But that's never to say I wouldn't do it at some point. I'd like to do it at some point.
Well, that's a good point then to bring in the second listener question. I chose just three because I know we will be running out of time anyway. But one that I chose is from PK on the Slow Twitch forum, who asks, how would you describe the role of the wider support team that you had during your career? And especially, let's say, the short distance years.
So, yeah, I had a very wide support team. And I saw it as, I guess, coaches, mostly who were Malcolm and Jack. I'd work with doctors, physios, strength and conditioning coaches, a masseuse, a nutritionist, and training partners, of which training partners were probably the most important because they were the people I spent day in, day out with, and ultimately trained hard with me. And, you know, when you're having a bad day on a rainy Monday, they're the people that are going to cheer you up. So they're very, very important people. Johnny as well. Really quite wide range. I did have coaches. I would turn up on a morning swimming session and the coach would have written a session on the board and I would do it. I mean, I controlled the intensity in the session. I basically controlled almost all my training outside of that, apart from running sessions where I'd turn up to a track and see the coach, Malcolm, to set the running session. But everything outside that was really my own. I think that great coaches, in my experience, people who are great at input, they're there all the time. They're consistently there and they're clever. They're great at communicating. But also they're very good at telling you, not only what to do, but what you're not doing. The people that I worked with are very good at just helping kind of guide me, you know, just prompt me here or there rather than tell me do this or that.
So you showed up to the swim with, I think was Jack Maitland was the swim coach, and then Malcolm Brown had the run sessions, and you showed up to those sessions. But then for things like all the aerobic volume that you were doing, and you did basically decided yourself what you were doing.
I had a week structure that I came up with that was the same thing every week, and so on a Monday I knew exactly what I was doing. I'd do that week in, week out. And then within that, I would experiment and say, right, okay, this Monday I'm going to add 10 minutes to this run and see what happens. And if it works, I'm going to do it again next week. And if it doesn't, I'll take it away again.
Yeah. All right. Let's do one or two more questions on training, and then we'll go into some of the things that you're doing in now, a post-active career. One question that I want to ask first is if you can give age group athletes one piece of advice for improving their swim, bike, and run from your perspective.
I'm really sorry, it's the most boring advice in the world, but consistency is everything, as hopefully I've explained. I mean, that leads to accumulating the volume over time, and that is as simple. The human body, I think almost all of human physiology can be described as that. You know, the more of something we do, the better your body adapts to it. And I'm very sorry, but accumulate time doing it.
You're of course correct, but let me drag something out of you, which is, first of all, if you are not training 30 plus hours per week, but you're training 10 hours a week, do you think that the easy volume can and should be slightly, also because you're not doing a 29 minute 10k, but you're maybe doing a 40 minute 10k or a 50 minute 10k, is there a smaller gap between your everyday pace and those, let's say, your thresholds or your race paces? And is that okay, or should people still actually, maybe, do you think that people
people are maybe getting, they're doing their easy stuff too hard, so regardless of that?
I must admit, I'm no expert at this. You know, I've kind of worked with people and helped people, but I'm genuinely no expert. But I do think it's important to maintain the intensity of your easy volume for two reasons. One is because physiologically, that's the intensity which I think is actually gives you the most ability to improve for the fatigue that it causes. And so that's important physiologically, and it's important so that you can get on with the rest of your life. I also think for most people, from a health point of view, I view everything as kind of decent, a chunk below kind of, let's call it LT1, but I actually, as long it has to be fairly easy for you. And again, that metric of, do I return feeling better than I started? Like, from a health point of view, what we know about general health and well-being, if you want to maximize metabolic benefits, you probably want to be in a zone where you're predominantly aerobically fat burning. If you want to maximize cardiovascular benefits, we think that the science says that you want to be approximately at the point where your maximum stroke volume occurs and not after it. And so we know that's at a low intensity. So from a physiological point of view and psychological, I would say still keep that low intensity low for all those reasons: performance, health, and to maximize your performance outside of training. The change I'd make is, you know, whatever that percentage was for me, let's say it's 10 or 15% intensity, you can definitely afford to, you know, at 10 hours of training, you can definitely afford to make that 30%, I would have thought. But I'd still, I think as long as the majority of what you do is slow, it's good. I think the trap that most people fall into is they do their low intensity stuff too hard, and that's neither healthy or good for your performance.
Yeah, you mentioned several reasons, but one that you mentioned earlier but didn't mention here that I think is worth repeating is that also helps you then perform better in the actual harder sessions, and especially if there's a higher proportion of intensity, then and there might not be as much physical stress, but there's a lot of outside stress outside of that, then that's also going to probably be helpful. So yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah, that's the point. One more thing to say on that is, I feel like I'm just an evangelist for low intensity training here, which I'm not meant to be. But I think it's a really good stress, physiological and psychological stress buffer as well. It's like, I notice it now that if you go out and I'm going easy enough to psychologically recover, and I come back and, you know, I feel kind of mentally fresher, physically fresher, you know, that to me is saying that it's kind of buffering the stress of life. And I think that's a really good thing. I think it's got to be a good thing for everyone, especially the less you're training, the probably more benefit it has, I would have thought.
Yeah. What I'm wondering is if we're talking about somebody like yourself, or even at a much lower level, but still somebody that in the past maybe they've done, you know, running or swimming at a collegiate level, so they used to be an athlete, train a lot, and then now they have a family, they have a job and things like that, so they have less time to train than they are used to doing in the past. They might be used to doing 15 hours and now they have 8 hours. I'm wondering if that athlete who has built up the capacity to train in the past can do the easier training slightly harder than the really easy stuff, because they've already built up well beyond the point of what their time budget allows them to train.
It's completely hypothetical, isn't it? But I think it's all relative, isn't it? So my easy is different to your easy, that's different to, you know, someone else really fast easy. So that relativity is important. And also where people's thresholds exist on that continuum is different as well. So people can get away with very different paces. So the question then is, how do you judge where easy is, I think, is the interesting question to ask. That's why I kind of like this very fuzzy, ill-defined, but definition of come back feeling better than you started, because you got to, you think if you've done that, you've probably not caused much neuromuscular damage, which means you've been running slowly if you've been doing it. If you, if you're feeling fatigued from endurance training, most people have felt fatigued because this is, I know it's hotly debated, but if you've had any type of hypoglycemia, you know, we, a lot of us associate that with fatigue. If you had hypoglycemia, to me, probably means that, yeah, you haven't been fueling right, but also for an easy training session, you've probably been at slightly too high intensity, because you should be able to metabolically manage that without getting hypoglycemic in some shape or form. So there's kind of a lot of, you haven't got too hot, so you haven't had to kick your metabolism too high. So there's a lot of things there that, you know, by defining it like that, you're kind of controlling for, and that allows people a window to be in. I'm not the kind of person that says you need to be at exactly this wattage and exactly this lactate, because I actually don't think you need to be. I think the window there is quite big, but I think we all probably know when we go over that window. You know, you go out and you come back and you sat on the floor and you're desperate for all the sugar in the cupboard. You've got it wrong, right? And so that's why I think that definition's kind of helpful.
Yeah. I think the duration also plays in there. The fitter you are, then the longer you can hold a certain pace and it still feels restorative, you feel as good or better than when you started. But that's probably where a lot of beginners especially might go wrong, because what feels very easy to them in the first part of a run, pretty quickly, even after a 20 to 30 minute run, it starts to be too much and they would actually have needed to go even easier. But the problem is that it feels so easy for them when they start out. There's just not that endurance base. But let's move into what you're up to right now. So I mean, you are up to a lot of things, but the first thing I want to talk about is True Fuels, which I guess you're a founder of, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And True Fuels came from two things. One was my experience of like talking to people and own experience that the number one thing that goes wrong in people doing endurance sport is probably nutrition. If you do an event, whether ultra run, cycling event, Ironman, whatever it might be, shorter distance triathlon, and something's gone wrong on race day, it's probably nutrition. And I was thinking, wait a minute, you know, this shouldn't be so complicated, and there's so much mystique around it. And you should just be able to say, look, for the vast majority of people that sit within the distribution of carbohydrate and sodium needs, if you just take this, you should be okay. And so there's that element. And then my own experience of, how can I simplify the product that I'm taking by cutting out as much as possible and simplifying the process of, if I can just have one thing that I have to sip every 10 to 15 minutes for the duration of this race, that's going to get me what I need. And my interest in the science. So, you know, reading of the literature over the years and following what in the sports nutrition world and just saying, yeah, it's changed a lot in the last decade or so, but still there's not tons of scientific literature out there on some of these topics. How can I kind of simplify that into a product and try and communicate it in a way that helps people maximize their own fueling?
Yeah, I mean, that's let's take one of those not nutrients. Like, is it a nutrient? Is sodium a nutrient? It's a mineral, or like a group of minerals? Like, it's a mineral. Anyway, with regardless of what sodium is, that's one thing that I wanted to ask you about, because it falls probably in that category where there isn't a whole lot of research. And the research that exists is often doesn't show much in terms of benefits for sodium. It's actually something that I recorded together with Jack, my co-host of the show, an episode on a few days ago that will be out by the time that listeners hear this. The point being there that anecdotally, I think most, at least coaches, but also some athletes, at least athletes that tend to lose more sodium than others, whether it be due to sweat rate or due to sodium concentration, they have kind of seen the benefits of sodium, but it hasn't really borne out in research yet. So
What is your take on that, having now developed electrolyte products, but also as an athlete, having used it and having done races like Kona, but also Cozumel and other hot races earlier on in your career?
I completely agree that the literature and, you know, if you have a sports scientist talk about this, they'd say that there's no evidence per se, or very little evidence, that sodium really contributes to people cramping and exercise performance. And I don't think you'll have had anyone on your show that would say, well, anecdotally, I'm going to do a really long hot race and not take sodium. So, I mean, there's quite a massive gap there in terms of the difference of opinion. And there must be something going on. And I don't know what it is. From a simple point of view, if you, all things being equal, you're doing a very long, hard, hot race, you've got enormous neuromuscular fatigue, you're dehydrated. If you have got sodium, if you've taken plenty of sodium and you haven't, I mean, anecdotally, I think everyone will tell you that you're much less likely to cramp if you've taken plenty of sodium on. The other thing is that, in my experience, sodium isn't the thing that causes GI distress, and I've tested that quite aggressively, and people are in different ways in terms of now the sodium bicarbonate products have enormous amounts of sodium in them, and people are taking quite large amounts of sodium and being okay, and it doesn't seem that sensitive. Like, chronically, sodium's quite bad for us, acutely doesn't seem to be quite bad. So the argument to make there is that if it isn't a GI problem for you and there doesn't seem to be long-term health negatives, you might as well kind of take the maximum amount of sodium-ish that you can take in. And if you do the maths on it, I mean, I know that my sweat rate actually could decrease quite a lot. My sodium sweat concentration could decrease quite a lot from both day in, day out. So this thing of testing your sodium sweat concentration and basing your nutrition strategy off it, I actually don't agree with, because I tested mine a lot and it would change. If I ate a salty pizza today, it'd be high tomorrow. And if I had a few days of being good, it would be low. So, I mean, that makes homeostatic sense. That's your body's job to mend homeostasis there and to get rid of sodium if you need to. And with heat training, if I spent a bit of time in the heat, my sodium sweat concentration could come down from nearly 2,000 milligrams a litre to right below, more like 500 or 600, I think. But if you do the maths, and I could sweat 3 litres an hour, say 1,000 milligrams of sodium per liter, that's 2.5 grams of salt. That's 7.5 grams of salt an hour. That's a lot of salt to lose. I know interstitial fluid has plenty of sodium, but the amount in blood circulation is nowhere near that amount. So you can cause a physical, and that's only in 1 hour. If you're talking about an Ironman over 8 hours, losing enormous amounts of it. So it does make sense to replace some of that. And that's all to say, that's my kind of common sense approach to this problem. I then thought that firstly, sodium should be included in the gel product, because I can't think of any scenarios really where you are intaking really, concentrated levels of carbohydrate in the form of a gel and you don't need sodium, because unless it's, I don't know, you're running a 5K in the Arctic and there's zero sweat involved. No, I'm joking. You're not going to sweat, but there's always going to be some level of sweat going on there. And then there's the argument, does it help carbohydrate absorption or not? I think you should always take sodium with carbohydrate. And in the principle of simplifying nutrition as much as we possibly can, it seems like you might as well simplify it. And so that's where the two fuels gel products came from, the ability to have a high sodium version and a lower sodium version in a gel to give people the options. If you're a higher sodium sweater, hot conditions, use the high one. And in general, if you're a lower sodium sweater in cool conditions, use the low sodium version. And the idea is, if you just take that, it's a 40 gram carbs, a 1-to-1 ratio. And for most people, taking 2 an hour will provide you if you're the vast majority of people sat within the normal distribution of what you need, will provide you what you need to do your endurance challenge.
Yeah, that's a lot of good stuff. And I think, listeners have to forgive me because I talked about this in that past episode that I referenced, but just to get your take on it, I speculate that some of the reason that the research isn't able to show a lot of benefits from sodium, there are multiple, but one of them is that there is such a variance in people's sweat rate and their sweat sodium concentration. So you might have somebody with a sweat rate of 3 liters an hour, like you said, and potentially 2000 milligrams per liter, which is then a huge amount of sodium, versus I have athletes that I've literally tested sweat rate tested multiple times, and it never passes 400 milliliters an hour in the conditions they test anyway. And then even if you have an average sodium concentration rate, then the absolute amount of sodium you lose is going to be very small. So probably insignificant for any race, unless potentially an Ironman where you're just going for such a long time that it starts to, but certainly not necessary for 7.132. But then in a randomized group, then you have people from these different ends of the spectrum and everywhere in between. So it's like comparing people with a VO2 max of 80 and VO2 max of 20 in the same research study, which is going to introduce a lot of just confounding factors in what sort of training people will respond to. So that's one of my pet theories as to why it's hard to show to get results with sodium.
I'm also not an expert on the protocols for everyone, but my experience of doing things in the lab is that you can't do anywhere near the intensity or the length that you can do outside. So, you know, it's very unlikely that people are really getting to the measuring to the point of fatigue or extreme that people get to in an Ironman. And we don't know whether is it a kind of linear impact risk ratio for cramp, or is there some kind of cliff edge, or is there some other ratio going on? I mean, that's what we don't know. Anecdotally, the people who tell you they struggle with cramp will tell you that there is some kind of cliff edge ratio, right? Relationship that you seem to get to a point and there's nothing you can do apart from having cramp. I've got one anecdotal experience. I was doing a long bike packing race in the south of Spain, and about 8 hours in, I'd had loads of punctures and I couldn't change the tire anymore because I kept getting cramp in my hands and forearms. And I had to get a salt packet out of my bike bag with my teeth using the zipper because my hands were so cramped. Anyway, I eventually ate 2 salt packets and sat there for 5 minutes and I was cured. So so it must work.
Yeah, that is funny. We are soon coming up on time. I know you need to go. So I'm going to rush ahead to one more question on what you're doing with TrueFuel. So you have one product that uses taurine for performance in the heat. So can you talk a bit more about that, how that works, and fill us in on the background of that?
Yeah, so this product called Core Control, so if I talk what it is first, it's a supplement that you take for 8 days and you mix it. It's kind of like a powder electrolyte, but you mix it with 500 mils of water. You take it, you can take it while exercising or just take it generally in the morning. I'm actually taking it at the moment because I'm doing a race in Costa Rica on Saturday that's going to be very hot. And you take the last dose the morning before the race. And it's based, I mean, the real active ingredient is in it is taurine, but I found that combining it with piperine for a bit of bioavailability, some electrolytes, because obviously you're sweating a bit more in the heat, and some mint flavor and cooling just for a bit of sensation. We kind of came up with the optimal product there. It was based on some science that I was really excited about. There's been a bit more work in the space now, but the big bit of work on it was done by a scientist called Jennifer Peel, who found really by using taurine over this period at about 50 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, which for most people is somewhere between 3 and 4 grams per serve, It helped people effectively boost their body's ability to increase evaporated heat loss and increase heat loss through a number. Although the mechanisms are actually kind of predicted because we've just seen the full response. She's got a number of kind of hypothesized mechanisms for it. And then there's some more acute work as well. One of those bits of work is done by a team a bit earlier, Page and Jeffries, that found acute taurine supplementation also helped. And I think of it really as doing a couple of things, effectively allowing your body to shed more heat. I know I can hear physics people hating me for that, but heat is energy and you have to get rid of energy. So let's just talk about heat. And that's the easiest way to think about it. And how does your body do that? Probably by increasing the kind of blood flow and the ability to transfer heat from the core somehow to the periphery, and then from the periphery to the outside environment, mostly by increasing sweat gland activation and increasing sweat rate.
Yeah, no, that's and what is the protocol? I think you have a loading phase and the acute phase. Can you go through that?
No, just really simple. It comes in packets of eight. You take it for the 8 days before the event with the last dose, and it's important because there is acute evidence. So take the last dose on the morning before the event, approximately 2 hours before. There's no negative side effects that anyone's found from using it yet, so don't worry about that. But as always, never try something for the first time on race day. Try a course before before you try it for a race. It's set up at the moment, so if you weigh over about 60 kilograms, you take one per each day. If you weigh under 60 kilograms, take it as 2 days on, 1 day off. So that means you actually take it over 12 days. And that's to balance out the suggested dosage. And that's it. You can take it, you can take it 24 days in a row if you want, three back to back. We're under the daily recommended limit. So, you can have more taurine per day if you want, but I always recommend not taking it every day for forever and ever. But there's no particular reason to recommend that, just in general, because we don't know the impact. If it's multi-day, you're thinking about, I would take it for 8 days before the first day of whatever you're doing, and then take it every morning before the event that day. And I would also say that, there's all kinds of things we don't know about it. And I'm actually conducting a randomized crossover trial at the moment with the local university. I've actually done my tests and had a placebo and the real thing, and did some tests of a study that I designed, which is really cool. But it definitely does increase sweat rates. How much depends on different people. Probably depends on how much your sweat rate already is kind of maximized for you. Be prepared to drink a bit more.
Yeah, which is the same as heat training in general. People are now doing more and more heat training, and it's great. It helps you tolerate the heat better and perform better in the heat. But you also need to be prepared to hydrate more, because otherwise you might be shooting yourself in the foot. I'm just going to ask you one more question, and you can do it as a bit of a rapid fire if you want to, and then I know you need to go. Can you list three things that you think are overrated and underrated for triathlon or endurance performance? If you can't come up with three, then just however many that come to your head in the moment.
Underrated, consistent volume, obviously. Also underrated, consistent performance, nutrition, and sleep. I mean, sleep is recovery 101 for sure. Overrated is worrying too much about what intensity you actually have to do. I mean, you have to do intensity, but actually, if it's the choice between going out the door and to do intensity and not doing anything, just go out the door and do easy stuff. If you're worried about doing what intensity you're doing and you're going to miss that group session, just do the group session. It's not going to make that much difference. to most supplements for most people, like vitamins and minerals. Some are really good, but actually by combining lots of things together, we don't know the impact of what's actually going on. So just find out what works for you, and actually less a lot of the time is better. And what's the final thing that's overrated? I've got to think of one more thing.
Swimming for age groupers, given how much you from
swimming for really no, let's end it. Swimming for me, yeah. swimming for me. I still cycle. I do one thing every day, basically, and that's normally cycling or running. It's always cycling or running. I think I've been swimming probably 5 times since I retired, and I've been cycling and running every day. So yeah, I think by definition, swimming is overrated.
You said consistent volume is underrated, but I mean, based on what you described about your training, would it be fair to say even volume? Because I think very few athletes come up to the just pure volume that you described that you were doing. Both back then and also now, there are probably some that are there or thereabouts, but not many, I would say.
Volume is important, but I think in the context of what most people are doing and how they're training, that's consistency. And I think the point to get across is what doesn't make the difference whether you're doing 30 hours this week or 35 hours, whatever. What makes the difference is, can over the next 50 weeks, can you average that? The body, if you think of what we think of the main response to endurance, without going very deep, we're running out of time, but your stroke volume, and your cardiac output. And my understanding of that is what we think, ultimately that's the shear forces of blood coming across it per beat at kind of maximum stroke volume. And it's literally the number of beats that you accumulate at that with that shear. And so it's accumulating heartbeats, and that you don't, you can't do that in 1 week. You've got to, you're doing it over years and years. And so actually, total volume maybe, but for most people, the context is make sure you can do that week in, week out.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Alistair. It's been really great to have a chat. And listeners, we'll put all the links to where you can follow Alistair in the show notes and the episode description. Make sure to follow him on Substack, because there's you have a lot of good articles there. And just one quick thing to the listeners as well. The best way to help this show is to share it. Word of mouth is how we can grow it. So if you enjoyed this episode, send it to a training partner, or in a WhatsApp group, or wherever you talk about triathlon, and that way we can reach more people, and it makes a massive difference. So thank you for that in advance if you share it. And Alistair, good luck with your business ventures, True Fuels, and everything else, and enjoy the continued exercising.
Thank you very much.